Welcome to the Abstract Veterans Podcast. Today, Dr. Char Gatlin and Kevin Sickinger speak with Alicia Swan. For more information, please visit limbic-cenc.org. Visit the Abstract Athlete for information and news. The Abstract Veterans Podcast with Char Gatlin and Kevin Sickinger.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Abstract Veteran Series, Season 3. It's good to be back. Good to have you tuning in. My name is Dr. Char Gatlin, and my co-host, Lieutenant Retired Kevin Sickinger, welcome you. So, Lieutenant, as you know from the last episode, this year's theme is health and wellness. You know, what can we do to make ourselves better, you know, when it comes to our mind, body, and spirit, you know? So this episode, we have a very special guest, Dr. Alicia Swan. Welcome, Dr. Swan.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no, it's tough sometimes to get people on here. Sometimes we have to bait them. Sometimes we have to bribe them. Sometimes we have to hook them, you know, that kind of thing. But we try to have a good time, and we try to break it down and, you know, put it out to the masses. So with that, Dr. Swan, tell us a little bit about yourself and sort of your interests.
Yeah, so I'm the Director of Rehabilitation Research at South Texas Veterans Healthcare System. I serve polytrauma and all of our PM&R, physical medicine and rehab services. I've been in this role for about a year, although I've been working with our VA and trying to understand the long-term outcomes related to traumatic brain injury for about a decade now. So a big part of what I do is work with the clinicians and the people who staff polytrauma who are looking to improve functional outcomes for our veterans that come through our doors in a really holistic, big picture way. So one of our jokes around polytrauma as research director is that I'm kind of the glue for people that are trying to take what they're seeing in the clinic and translate it into evidence-based practice and medicine. Because I can do all the things, I just don't have the insights that my clinical partners have. So we have a really cool partnership where I get to fill those gaps and help them connect with the research side.
No, and partnerships are key, the interdisciplinary component, just like I got criticized. I'm sorry for demoting you there, Kevin. Actually, Kevin just pointed out that I demoted him from lieutenant colonel to lieutenant.
Oof.
That's quite the demotion. I'm sure I'm going to hear a little bit about that later because my term of rank was captain. So my apologies, sir. And okay. we'll deal with that.
That's after okay,
that.
Doctor.
So tell us, and may I call you Alicia?
Of course. Yeah.
How'd you get involved with TBI? I read some interesting, some backgrounds, and I think I don't want you to go too deep, but I think it would benefit some of our listeners to hear about some of that tenacity and perseverance that you showed to get going down the path. Please.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I can do the elevator pitch because like academics and scientists, we love talking about ourselves. It's literally our favorite thing. But I actually started in brain injury research as an animal researcher in 2006. So I did preclinical research looking at long-term functional outcomes using rat models of brain injury. I actually got into that because I had a really good friend in college who I kept in contact with, who was in a really unfortunate car accident up by Chicago and now is permanently disabled. And when I was applying to graduate school, I got an offer to go to Southern Illinois to study brain injury, kind of by happenstance, because the lab was open, they needed somebody. I wasn't really looking for it, but it felt like kind of fate, I guess. And so that's when I, in part because they recruited me so hard, which felt really great, because I took 2 years off between college and graduate school working as a financial planner for military families, as it were, that I was like, wow, so life is telling me this is the direction. So that's how I got into brain injury research a long, long time ago. That's the short version.
We have a similarity there between college and joining the Army. I actually did financial planning for about 8 months and just could not see myself doing it for any longer than 8 months. And decided I was driving down Broad Street in Richmond and saw the recruiting station and stopped in and signed up. So, yes. Going back to your initial comments about the glue and bringing all the things together, it's very interesting because we have been studying. I mean, you were with us back in Cincy days. So during Cincy, we had pretty much every study designed to try to figure out how to get to the brain, whether it was through the ear, through the eye, through balance. There was all kinds of ways we're trying to get to the brain to see how it was damaged. And it reminded me, it kind of, the first thing that stuck out when you said that was a lot of docs do their specialty. And so it's kind of like if you're a hammer, every problem is a nail.
Looks like a
so
nail.
If you are an eye doctor, then everything obviously has to do with the eyes. And so you being able to bring all of these different docs together to help, because TBI is a multi-issue problem, and it takes somebody to do it. So what are some of the things that you're doing with these multiple docs to help bring it together?
Sure. So part of that is that I have a really varied background in my research training because I spent about 10 years doing animal research. And then I met Mary Jo Pugh and she was like, you could do veterinary research. And I'm like, those are very large animals. But I started working with her and it's like a lot of the basic skills of project management translate. But it also means I understand a lot at the cellular like mechanism level for traumatic brain injury, because that's a lot of what you do in animal models. The part that gets difficult is the behavior. So what I've been doing for the last 10 years is spending more time with understanding behavior and trying to be big picture. Because whereas you're kind of indicating that a lot of professionals in the space have their specialty and they're very like kind of into that specialty, I don't really have a specialty. I'm more of a generalist because I've dipped my toes into all of these different places before. And I would be lying if I said that sometimes I didn't feel like that made me less of a good scientist because I don't have that hyper-focused specialty. What it means in my job is that I'm able to listen to people describe what they're seeing in their clinic, in their practice, in their research, and say, have you thought about this other thing in this other discipline that we've already seen and talked about in that discipline, but sounds like it hasn't kind of hit its renaissance in your area yet? Because it's one of the pitfalls we have all the time, because brain injury and the long-term outcomes and functionality after it are so multidimensional, is that we discover something, we see something, we're like, oh, this is the first time this has ever been seen. No, it's the first time you're seeing it. Other people have seen it. They might have described it differently. So I try and bring some of that big picture perspective from the research side. On the other side of it, it's more logistical. Like my clinician partners in polytrauma are so busy, and doing research at the VA is its own kind of cult in a way. In fact, that's how my boss describes research. He says it's a cult. And that's because you have to know so much about it to actually do your work at the VA and actually be functional in doing that, because it takes so much time and knowledge. And I do research full time. So when I have a partner who's like, hey, I want to see if brain health education for my patients is actually changing how they approach their rehabilitation, I can help them do all the paperwork to actually get that science done, to actually design the study and run the stats and collect the data. So I provide a lot of that tangential, like the tangible support in actually getting that work done. They have the brilliant ideas. I just help them realize them.
I think it goes further than that. Oh, there's Alicia sounding off to tell me to give my dogs their medicine. Sorry about that, if you guys. No. Not Alicia, I'm sorry, Alexa. Gee whiz, my mind is so caught up.
You're welcome.
So you mentioned, we'll shift gears here for a moment. You mentioned earlier that that you attended SIU, Southern Illinois University. I went to high school in Memphis, and we had several people that went up there into their theater program. And they had actually a very, maybe not quite what you're doing, but it's interesting, the academic component. And it got me thinking, looking over, I see that you still teach. Yes, that's what I thought. So tell us a little bit about Prof Talk. I'm curious to hear about this.
Oh, yeah.
And how you engage with your students, because I think what you just said, you know, being able out there to help people understand, to bring them along, to integrate them, to expose them, if you will, you know, to different methodologies, different ways of thinking, sort of diversity of thought, for lack of a better term. I'd like to hear a little bit about that, and I think probably our listeners would too.
Okay, absolutely. So you asked about Prof Talk. So prior to my current position, I was a professor at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I was there for about 5 years in the Department of Psychology. I was basically the resident behavioral neuroscience person, which is still how I kind of describe my work, but that's technically more of like a neuroscience way of describing functional outcomes after brain injury. But Prof Talk is a twitch.tv stream that we've been running for just under 3 years now. And so we stream occasionally on Tuesdays, but it's myself and another assistant professor. And we talk with professionals in and around the discipline of psychology, because that's technically my home base. And we ask them about their jobs, what they do, how they got there, and tips they would give people that want to go where they are, I guess, professionally. It all started, I want to say November 2020, because when we were all sent home to teach online, it was probably one of the most isolating things I'd ever experienced, and our students had experienced. And I went to UTSA. UTSA recruited me because, well, I wanted to teach. I wanted to have more of an active engagement with the next generation of scientists. I was actually at the VA full time at that point, doing research with Mary Jo Pugh as her program manager, actually. And so Prof Talk is super fun. I've learned so much through Prof Talk, because we've just connected with a lot of people in different disciplines. So we've had a lot of positive feedback on it. And it was something we kind of decided on like a Sunday that we were going to try to do. And on Tuesday we were doing. And it was like 2 hours of tech. I do all the tech with the OBS and the streaming and getting everything going. And I MC it a little bit. I get a lot of comments that I've got golden retriever energy, which is 100% correct.
That's funny.
So I'm perfect for Prof Talk, because I'm in it. I'm so excited to be there and live it. So I think we have almost 40 episodes now. And it's a great resource in a way that I never would have expected, because people talk to me a lot about career decisions, which is a whole vibe if you know how of like a curly Q line my career has been. Even Kevin mentioned, I actually met him almost 10 years ago when I was the clinical coordinator for the original incarnation of Sensi Limbic in San Antonio, because I stood up the study a long, long time ago. Prof Talk's been just so cool, because we learn a lot about jobs I would have never thought of. Probably my favorite, one of my favorites, I'll give you a couple anecdotes because they're fun. Number one is media psychology. We actually met somebody that does the design for the Xbox, like main menu interface. And it's very Silicon Valley, but they have a psych background, and they use their psychology background and their stats training to actually design the Xbox basic interface with all the apps. And that was so cool. I was like nerding out so hard. I was like, I wish I would have known this was a thing, because this is so cool, because I love the way that people interact with their environment. I find that really fascinating. The other one is that the FBI, we had a FBI analyst, like a forensic psychologist, come on at one point. It was actually by popular demand. It's our most visited stream. We had a really big crowd during the live stream. She was a forensic psychologist who sits in an office. And then the stream was so popular around the FBI office that she worked in, that the FBI approached us to do another stream with a field office from Milwaukee.
Are you getting some of this wrong?
Yeah, so we actually had this trio of FBI field agents on, and they worked for the organized crime unit. And at one point, the more senior gentleman on that crew was like, yeah, I helped interview John Wayne Gacy. And I was like, wait. And so Prof Talk is super fun, because you hear about what people actually do. And that's something I think is really missing from figuring out what you want to do for a job, for a career, particularly for students at, say, UTSA, which is 50% Hispanic serving institution, like 50% of our students are Hispanic, and 50% are first gen. So they've never, they don't have any family members that have ever gone to college before. And a lot of college and beyond is kind of a who you know and how you know them and how connected you are and how much of that insider knowledge you have. And it's like, it's been so wonderful doing Prof Talk because it helped me get through the ennui of the fact that my career was kind of a like non-straight line, because a lot of people have this like fear that they're not going at their career fast enough, hard enough, achieving like the most they could as quickly as possible. Almost everybody on Prof Talk has a story where they like, well, I was a tattoo artist for 6 years and then I went to graduate school. Or we had somebody who ran a mortuary for 4 years because part of their family business, and they decided to go back and do hospice care. And just all the stories did so much to normalize that you need to learn what you like. And failure actually is good a lot of the times, because you learn what you don't like. And that's so effective in finding where you're going to be happy in the end.
I was thinking of lots of questions as you were talking there, but then the last part kind of really brought home a question. So speaking of learning from failure, what are we doing in the terms of treating TBI or treating comorbidities of TBI or, you know, sequelae of TBI that might not be working, and what, you know, what should the future look like?
Oh, that's such a big question. Well, I think as a field, we're moving in an awesome direction towards creating larger, more comprehensive longitudinal databases that are helping to capture a more holistic picture of symptom burden, functioning, clinical complaints. Like one of the things that makes concussion or mild TBI really challenging is that so much of it is subjective. And I mentioned I used to work with animal models. Part of where animal models start to fall apart is that like the experience with concussion is inherently psychological, that you can't test in animals in a true way. So you have to work with human models and the limitations that we have. And so I have a psychology degree, but not a license. So in the state of Texas, I'm not a psychologist. But trying to understand how people relate with their own state of being is one of the ways I could see brain injury and our understanding of outcomes and how people experience them can be advanced in the next 10 to 15 years. Just like people are notoriously disconnected from themselves and what they actually think and what they need and what they want. And I think A, the approach to more data, and B, following up on things where, like, I think there might be some ambiguity in what people are saying and what they're actually experiencing and what they truly want or need to feel like they're functioning best. Because it's so complex. But it's, yeah.
A lot of times when people get hurt, you know, I don't want to say they're classified, but people from the outside may classify them into a certain category. And it was very interesting your comments earlier about, you know, you don't know what you want to do, you know, and you have different career paths because people may be telling you, or you don't know, you know. I was looking at one of your articles here, the Association of Functional Impairment and Life Satisfaction among veterans, you know, and it was interesting in the conclusions that you found, but, you know, one of those was sort of was recreation. But when you look at the absence of PT, and the body's intertwined like that, you know, if you're physically, you don't feel good, then maybe emotionally, spiritually, mentally, you know, you don't either. A significant overlap, a very odd Venn diagram, if you will. But I think, you know, for a lot of the folks out there, they sometimes think that they can't do it. You know, sometimes my speech gets off in the evening because I'm tired. You know, I'm really amazed sometimes I can make it through these things without really tripping up too much. But, you know, people hearing that you can do this, you know, you can push your career forward, you can change your path. I mean, no one's not telling you you can, even though you have functional impairment. You know, one of the big things I think is for people and, you know, families or whomever to reach out, you know, and give support. I just think it's, and I don't know how you would really comment on it, but I think sometimes, and I'm trying to say this in the most politically correct way, but coming out of military medicine back in the day when they didn't really understand, you know, the complexities of TBI and some of that interdisciplinary component, you know, they were willing to take a person that maybe tested on A, B, and C on some people and to put them over here, you know, and not address some of these underlying secondary and tertiary issues that could in turn help that person fix the primary problem, you know, and get back out there into the workforce or get back there into the community and thus improve the life satisfaction, which in turn is going to improve satisfaction for everyone else that surrounds it, because misery deserves company. You know what I'm saying? You know, very, very, it's not really a question per se. It's just a very different way of looking at it. I think, you know, folks should always, if you're out there, I mean, take that into consideration. You know, I mean, there's no reason you need to stop. And there's no reason that anybody's going to tell you to stop. Go give it a shot. And, you know, to the comment I think Kevin made earlier about, you know, you don't really can't understand success unless you've tasted failure. You know, and I've been behind the eight ball, I don't know how many times, man. I can't even count. Not to say that I ever tasted success either, but I've come close a couple of times. At least I hope I have. But it's interesting to see that, like, say, interdisciplinary approach that you discussed. And then, you know, as we tie it into the show, you know, with the wellness, you know, component, the mind, body, and spirit, and so forth. So as I said, just more of a comment than anything.
Yeah. Well, you make me want to bring up the concept of expectation as etiology, which I realize these are like major GRE words, but the way we think about our own ability to change is actually really meaningful in this rehab context. Like what we think we can do, what we expect of ourselves, what we think is possible. Like one of my big pet interests, and for full disclosure, I'm married to a clinical psychologist who specializes in PTSD. So we talk like on this intellectual kind of like big picture, societal, cultural level, not irregularly. And it's really interesting to think about how history, how context, how our own language shapes how we understand our own ability to change, to exist, to function. And so, like one great example I love to share that we've talked about is the idea of flashbacks. Like, because we talk about those as like a symptom related to PTSD all the time.
Of course. You know, yeah,
part of
course.
Our lexicon, right? That's actually a relatively new word, like concept. Like it was probably popularized in the 1970s as a movie mechanism. It existed before that, but PTSD is not new. But now the way we conceptualize that experience is frequently tethered to the language that we use to describe it. And I think that's true for people too. Like there are definitely people who get lost in that sauce of like, oh, I'm so down, I'm so incapable, I have so many limitations. And I don't want to diminish the impact that limitations might have on somebody's experience. But if you can remind yourself that there are infinite possibilities, the future has a lot more degrees of freedom that you can go realize and enjoy and have that impact with. It's like my pet project.
Taking that, the next step with the prop talk, if you were to be the academic advisor in a high school or junior college, when young kids are still making their decision, which route they might want to take, and also having worked in the VA for as long as you have,
mm-hmm.
smush those two together. Dealing with needs, veterans, and dealing with possibilities for younger people coming into this field. What would you, if you had to do it all over again, what would you recommend? What would be a cool field to go into, knowing that it's going to make an awesome impact?
And this isn't a trick question, by the way.
No, it's okay. Shame is something I abandoned when I started playing roller derby a while back. So I'm nothing scares
roller
me.
Roller derby, really? Wow.
Yes. I'm retired right. now, but the, cool. It gets in your soul. So shame is something you abandoned a while back. I'm like, I can't be embarrassed. It's impossible.
No, it's definitely, yeah.
But I would say I would go back and I would push, and I do this all the time because a lot of the students at UTSA come into college and they're carrying the expectations and wants and desires of their families more than they're carrying their own. So I would say, know yourself, get to know yourself, and quit putting all that crazy pressure on yourself to be perfect immediately, because that's not helping anything. I really struggled after I got my PhD, because I didn't know who I wanted to be as a professional, other than I was really not in love with animal research anymore, because it's a very hard, long hours, lonely job. And I'm a golden retriever. I need people. And I was in a basement with animals doing surgery 8 hours a day at a point, and I was very unhappy with my life. So I push my students to think about what they do want, what is important to them. Like, do you want to have a job you go to for 40 hours a week, or is a job going to be like a career for you where you're really invested in that, and you find the passion to do that outside of those typical 40 hours, because that's our culture. So I would push students to kind of be more real with themselves about what they actually want their life to look like, and try and work all those pieces at the same time. Because I get a lot of students in psychology who are like, I just want to go become a clinical psychologist. And that's more competitive than med school now, for a lot of weird reasons. But that's a big thing I hear. And now I find myself steering students to more allied health professions where they can still have that patient impact that they crave, but they're not in school and incapable of driving what's going on in their life for a decade, because that's the path that clinical psychology looks like. So that's what I would say. I would like, hang out with yourself and get to know what you'd like. Because I think if I could go back, I'd probably do more stats training. Because I really like stats. That's an easy skill.
No. We're not going to. Stats. Brutal stuff.
I'm weird. I almost became an actuarial. Like, I almost did actuarial science in college. I went to Purdue.
I still have nightmares about stats, man.
Oh, yeah. No, I love
it. It was interesting, but nightmares. But I think you've got a good takeaway message for some of our veterans out there. You know, when a lot of these guys and girls, you know, and individuals are going back to school, being non-traditional status, you know, having a few years under their belt, and they're coming into an environment that they haven't seen in a long time, you know, and as you've described, the golden retriever, you know, these folks are kind of like bulldogs, more or less, you know, they're just going to kind of stay to themselves, but they're friendly when you talk to them and give them a treat. But a lot of the folks that I saw, you know, coming back didn't really know what they wanted to do, and they seemed to be kind of locked in a box. There was only certain things, mm-hmm. you know, and one of the things that I think that you highlighted, you know, for some of this population was, you know, think outside the box when you go back. You know, don't just be don't go solo. You know, there's other people out there that can help you, that can work with you. And there might be a career field out there, and it takes you time to sort of figure it out. Don't get me wrong. But that you can go into it, you know, and limitations that you think you may have, or maybe you do have them, don't necessarily always have to get in the way if you get creative, if you're a creative thinker, you know, and you think outside the box. When you were kind of mentioning, and Ron hit us there with the time limit, so we're getting towards the end of this. When you mentioned limitations, I knew a kid many, many years ago was a wrestler. I wrestled for many years when I was younger. And, you know, he only knew two moves, and everybody used to laugh at him, but he knew those two moves so well that he was a two-time state champion. You know, and that's, you know, he took his limitations, but he focused on what he could do. And I think that's a message for a lot of our, you know, vets that are going back in the classroom. You know, I mean, there's a lot you don't know, particularly stats. And I would, and you're going to have to take it, folks. So get ready for it. You're going to have to do it. Yeah. But, you know, use your, you know, those limitations, figure out what they are, and then work around them, and then, you know, move forward. There's nobody stopping you, for sure.
Yeah. So I want to touch on that going back to school piece real quickly, because, sure. There's a lot of, like, at UTSA, we serve a lot of student veterans, and there's a lot, we gravitate towards each other naturally, I think.
Yes, they do.
I'm not a veteran. I wish I was.
No, they do. That's
true. Air Force didn't want me. I tried. Non-traditional students are the best students. They know exactly what they want. They come in, they work hard, they communicate typically very well. I've had a really incredible experience, particularly with student veterans. In fact, most of the students I mentor on the research side, and I've now brought into the Limbic Sensei family, are veterans. And even like my now postdoctoral fellow, Liz Sanford, who's absolutely incredible, and she's a 10-year Navy veteran. She's actually older than I am. And just her experience, her perspective is so invaluable. So I know that people are stepping into that student space and thinking like, oh, I'm so not like these other people. these traditional students have come right out of high school. No, but you're great. Like wonderful part of our community. Please join us. We need you to do this work and do it well. Sorry.
Yeah, I did some of that. It was unfortunate that, you know, we waste education. And this sounds terrible. We waste education on the youth. I mean, I remember my undergraduate was, I played baseball, and I majored in eligibility. That was the only thing I had to keep a 2.0 to be able to play. And that's what I took. That's how I ended up a psychology major, believe it or not. Funny thing is, I didn't even know I was a psychology major. I thought I was a criminal justice major, but it was psychology with the emphasis in criminal justice.
Right.
We've gone from A to Z and different topics. Is there anything that we've missed? Anything that you'd like to mention before we shut it down?
Yeah, I want to encourage our service members and veterans to stay engaged with researchers, with the clinical services, with our communities, so that we can do increasingly high quality science that meets people where they are and actually changes and improves the way our lives get to be lived, because we couldn't do it without that partnership. And that's absolutely what we're trying to do here in San Antonio with polytrauma and rehab medicine and research, is meeting people where they are and hearing them for what they're really saying, and making that a true partnership all across the board. That's what we need.
No, it's very, very true. Well, we've hit our time. Alicia, thank you for your time, for coming in here. I mean, this has been a interesting, what is today, Thursday morning laugh-in, but it's been very informative. And as Kevin said, A to Z alphabet, sometimes what we cover. But no, it was great meeting you. And thank you for all the work that you do out there in the community. I mean, it's good. Hopefully folks tuning in, it's just, we get that vibe and that spirit and that just smiling. And as you say, that golden retriever mentality, and get out there and make a world a better place, not only for veterans and our communities, but everyone. You know, times we live in, we need it, that's for sure. So thanks again for being here. If you have any links, by the way, or any information that you'd like to share with us or kick out, kick it to one of us or into Ron up top, and we'll put it on there. So if folks, you know, have questions or follow up or have any interest in anything that we've talked about, or maybe they're noticing something by what we say, they can get in touch with us. And if we can't help you, we'll definitely point you in the right direction. You know, there's no doubt about that. So thank you again. And don't be a stranger. Don't be a stranger.
Never.
I mean, check us out. And if you've got any ideas for us, please let us know. And when's your next roller derby match? Or is the season?
I retired.
Retired. Oh, okay. I didn't. Well, here we go.
But yeah, they have a game this weekend. So it's the Alamo City Roller Girls.
Right on. Yeah. Montana has a team up here, and I went to a couple matches, and that's a tough sport. I got to tell you, people. Yeah. Saying football and wrestling and everything else, roller derby, that's great for stress management. I imagine so. I know several people I should probably get to enroll in it, actually. So anyway, hey, we won't keep you. You've got things to do. Thank you for being here. And once again, I'd like to thank my co-host, Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Sickinger. Just make sure we get that one correct on
Thanks
that.
Thanks for the promotion.
Ron up top in the box, and the team that remains unseen. Thank you for your time to keep the wheels on the bus rolling. And we will see you next episode. Have fun, and everybody take care.
Thank you to Alicia Swan for joining Dr. Char Gatlin and Kevin Sickinger today on the Abstract Veterans Podcast. For more information, please visit limbic-cenc.org. The Abstract Veterans is produced by The Abstract Athlete. For more information, please visit theabstractathlete.com. And as always, please follow us on our social media platforms under The Abstract Veterans, The Abstract Doctors, and The Abstract Athlete. See you soon for our next episode.